And it's time for Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I am here with Ron. And
hello, Dr. Fran.
And we will be here for the next hour with Radio Naturopath. Great information for you about health and natural medicine. We would like to invite you to participate in our show. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com, and you can also text us at 860-486-9487. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Fran. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. So you sent me some information about chemicals that are allowed in organic foods.
I did. I thought maybe this would be a good time for some discussion about buying local and knowing who you're buying from and trusting your local growers, because it's, you know, farmers market season and CSA meat season. And so I thought that because there are so many people out there that are purchasing organic food from grocery stores, maybe they should know what's in their organic food.
Right. So, for example, there are certain things that are allowed to be put on organic foods and you can still get a label of organic, and rotenone is one of them. It was used in the U.S. as an organic pesticide for a long time. It's natural in origin. It occurs in the roots and stems of some subtropical plants. It was considered safe and organic, but research has shown that rotenone is highly dangerous because it kills by attacking mitochondria. And you know how I feel about mitochondria. Mitochondria are extremely important. They are the little energy centers of all of the cells in your body. So it's really important to realize that when you're buying organic in the store, you don't always know that if the product that you're buying has had some organically allowed pesticides sprayed on it or some other chemicals. The other thing that's interesting is that the chemicals that could be put on your organic food doesn't necessarily pass the European Union standards, so they're not used in the European Union. So that's interesting too. So you're not always going to know. So if you buy an organic product from a big farm at the supermarket, you're not necessarily going to know what products it has, and it depends on exactly what methods are used by the crop producers. There's an issue that way. So this is kind of interesting. So the article that I'm reading comes from Nutrition Wonderland, and I think it's mildly anti-organic, that just because it's organic doesn't mean it's more healthful. And that is true. Some organic foods can be just as nutritious as non-organic foods. But having said that, that all depends on the grower. Now, if you have a grower, like some of the local growers that you'll find right here around our area, for example, at the local farmers markets, those growers, depending on how they grow their food, they are going to be far more nutritious than anything that you can buy in a store. And they actually have their food studied. So, for example, if you go to Tobacco Road Farms, Brian O'Hara has his food studied, and the nutrient content is found to be much, much higher than organic food sold in the stores, or certainly non-organic food sold in the stores. So that actually is grower by grower. Just because it's labeled organic in the supermarket doesn't mean it's more nutritious than something else organic that's in the supermarket. But if you're going to your local grower, you can talk to your local grower about how they were growing their food. And I can tell you that the local growers around here, that if you do go to the local farmers markets, are by and large using farming methods where they use no chemicals whatsoever. They don't use any organic or non-organic chemicals. They do use some organic minerals, and beyond that, they don't use chemicals at all. They use compost. They use healthy farming practices like crop rotation. They understand what goes into the soil, and their food is going to be far more nutritious for you than things that you buy in the supermarket. So looking into farmers markets and local CSAs, you're going to get a better deal. You're generally going to get more nutrition and a better deal for your food than if you just buy it from things that are sourced from far away. It's not necessarily that you can't get things that are very nutritious from far away. It's just that it's a lot harder to talk to the growers and find out what's going on. And you can sometimes the growers will actually let you come to their farm and show you what they're doing, but they certainly will talk your ear off about what they're doing. So for my money, I like to go to farmers markets, and I like to use CSAs or people that use CSAs. And I find that I get a very healthy product. I get a really tasty product. And there, for example, if I buy arugula at the local farmer's market, it's incredibly spicy. So the nutrients that are in it that give it those spicy notes, the mustard notes, the isothiothionates and the other compounds that give mustard its characteristic spicy flavor, they're going to be higher because the gene expression is going to be higher in those foods because they are grown with nutrition that helps them to be much healthier. So this is a shout out to all the farmers markets in the area. Big shout out to Coventry and to stores where you will frequently find Ron and me on a Saturday afternoon, to Willimantic Farmers Market, to the Ellington Farmers Market, to the Lebanon Farmers Market, to the Ashford Farmers Market, which is on Sundays. If I'm not mentioning your farmers market, I apologize, but because there are many, many to name, and I think they're wonderful. And one great thing for you to do is to find the farmers market that's closest to your home. Because that's going to be the most convenient one for you, and you're going to get food that grows really close to your house. And then you can get to know those farmers. It's a really great thing. The answer to whether you're getting chemicals on your organic food at the supermarket is to buy local, is to go to your farmer's market and talk to the farmers about their growing practices and what they use and what they don't use. And it just so happens that right here in Connecticut, in northeastern Connecticut, we have some of the best food ever. It's really incredible. So
it's really nice to live here. It really is. And we have some great resources, too. The local farmers here are very well educated as to what they're doing and how they're doing it. So it's really great. And that's, that's half the fun of going to the farmers markets. You go there and you get to learn something when you go there because you hear the different techniques they're using to grow things, and you're learning about what they use as far as fertilizer goes, which is generally organic matter. But also you get to hear how they deal with pesticides and the lack thereof because they're not using them, and how they control, bugs and varmints. So,
right. Yeah. And if there are absolutely no bugs on your food, there's probably been some kind of nasty chemical applied to them. And the other thing that Brian always tells us is that that bugs go after unhealthy plants, that if the plant is super healthy, it's going to be less likely to be eaten. I'm not quite sure how that works, but an unhealthy plant is going to be more likely to be eaten and attacked by insects, whereas something that's really, really healthy and has all the right nutrition in it is going to be less likely to be attacked by insects and critters and stuff.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it is very interesting.
And it makes sense. It makes sense that, something that's a little bit weaker would be attacked.
Yes, and also I think there's got to be a scientific reason for that. And my guess is, just like us, we have an immune system that keeps things at bay because, you and I are walking seas of microbiota. We have bacteria and viruses and fungus all over and inside us.
Beg your pardon?
Yeah, you could beg my pardon all you want. Every person, listen, if you don't have microbiota all over you, you're in a bubble and you have no immune system.
Oh, that's not good.
Or you are not with us. Mm. Yeah, I mean, if you are not a walking sea of microbiota, you are in trouble. And I have a brilliant scientist who I know who says that he thinks that microbiota are driving evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah. So microbiota are really, really important. So you're going to have healthy microbiology on your food. And in fact, you don't necessarily have to take probiotics in a pill, because if you eat organic, locally grown produce, there's going to be probiotic on the produce. That's where it grows because it's in the soil. That's where it came from in the first place. I mean, people didn't take probiotic pills, in hunter-gatherer times, and they certainly were full of microbiota. but they're getting it directly from the soil, and it's on your plants. And if it's on organic plants, so the other thing is, why would an organic plant be able to be disease resistant? It's because they have an immune system. They have compounds in them that are going to discourage unfriendly bacteria, virus, and mold from growing. They're going to have compounds on them that are just not going to let that happen. And they're going to have compounds on them like volatile oils that are going to scare bugs away. I mean, you know, you put volatile oils on yourself to scare bugs away.
Right.
So, you know, there's going to be volatile oils in the microbiology, in the food, on your produce, that's going to scare bugs away as well. So that's part of how that happens. So
Mother Earth News has a list of things that are the most bothersome for you as far as your garden goes. And number one on their list is slugs.
Slugs.
You know, like tomato worms and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, nasty little critters. Slimy critters. And they talk about different ways that you can deal with slugs. Eggshell barriers. Crushed eggshells sprinkled around the plants.
Oh, but that's going to kill them. It's kind of violent.
Kill the slugs?
Yeah.
Kill the slugs or kill the food you're eating?
I know.
Make
but that's
choice.
How it's going to work.
Make
you're going to have these sharp shards of eggshell, right. And the slugs are going to go over them, and they're going to die. It's just so sad.
And that's with the 33% failure rate among gardeners who had tried that slug control method. An easy home remedy that received widespread support was beer traps. Have a little beer party for your slugs.
Slugs like beer?
Would they? I guess so.
That's pretty funny.
But it's a problem when they get into the beer. I guess it's a problem.
Oh.
I don't know if it dissolves them or if they just get drunk.
Well, that's too bad. Slugs have high alcoholism rates.
Yes.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
They're terrible.
Well, slugs have an osmotic problem. That's why if you put salt on them, they explode.
Right. And so for those of you who are not into that method, there's also things like chickens, garter snakes, and ducks, which appear to really love slugs.
Yeah. I have no problem with garter snakes. I know some people have a fear of snakes. I'm not afraid of any animal if it's not going to hurt me. And if I know a snake is not poisonous and it's not going to hurt me, I'll pick it up and play with it and stuff. And garter snakes are generally harmless, and they're really good to have in your garden because they will keep pests. They eat bugs and they eat rodents, and they will keep pests down, and having other snakes around. That's why I encourage people with snakes. If you go to the DEP has a website where you can see pictures of Connecticut snakes, and I think there's one or two poisonous snakes in Connecticut and the rest are not. And that's why you should really know your snake identification, because if it's not a poisonous snake, you should leave it alone. In fact, you should probably leave it alone if it's poisonous too. And generally the poisonous snakes they don't come out. You're not going to see a poisonous snake usually sunning itself in the road. And so when I see a snake in the road, I herd it off. I either, you know, get a stick and let it wrap around the stick and put it off the road, or I herd it with my bike. I chase it, and it kind of winds its way off the road, and off it goes. We do that with turtles, too. Well, the turtles, if it's not a snapping turtle, I'll pick it up and move it. And if it is a snapping turtle, then we either herd it or let it bite a stick and drag it. So, yeah. So that's a nice thing to do. All right. So, having snakes around, and if you can keep chickens or if you can keep guinea hens around.
Well, ducks too.
Ducks.
Ducks apparently really like slugs, and they give you eggs.
Aww.
So the ducks give you eggs.
Want to get some
not
ducks?
The slugs. No, but, you know, I mean, if you get the problem is we have other predators that would like the ducks and would like the chickens and would like
no.
the, you know, so the, it requires a little more maintenance.
I feel that we don't have enough snakes on our property. We probably need more.
Probably.
We need
cats too. It seems like
with
all the toads we have on our property, it seemed like the snakes would be very happy, but I believe they eat toads.
Yeah, they eat toads, and they'll eat rodents.
And the toads, we're into toad season. We have this really funny thing that happens right outside our sliding door. We have a big glass sliding door. And right outside there, of course, the toads hang out because all the light from the inside of the building goes out at night and the bugs all bounce off the glass. The toads sit there and just eat to their heart's content.
And then we have these enormous toads.
We have these enormous toads by the end of the summer. They're huge.
And then you pick them up and they pee.
Yeah,
and
they do.
And he yells at me for picking them up. I think they're cute.
I don't yell at her for picking them up. I just warn her that they're going to pee on you.
And they do.
And
so you just hold them away, let them do their thing.
And your nephews were the same this weekend. Hmm. They were up and they were picking up toads because they were fascinated by them.
Well, they're fun.
And they kept doing that New Jersey thing, calling them frogs. But they're not frogs. They're not toads. Right.
Some
they're
of them toads. Could be frogs.
And the frogs are down by the water. The toads are on the land.
Okay. Well, toads are still amphibious. They still need a place to lay their eggs.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're not going to find them up by our house as much.
The frogs.
The frogs,
right,
as you would the toads.
Yeah.
So it's
all
just
right.
That's the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Squash bugs. Squash bugs.
They eat your squash?
I guess so. Hand picking is the primary defense.
Oh.
Oh, that's
so
not
you have
good.
To go say, oh, yeah. Look, I have a squash bug. Grab, throw.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So, anyway, that seems to be one of the aphids. That is another one right there.
Yeah.
They were on the watch list of 50% of the respondents. Various rates of control. Oh, gosh. But, yeah. Sweet alyssum?
Sweet
right?
alyssum, yeah. Sweet alyssum. It's a lovely flower.
Attract hoverflies, which eat aphids.
It's a beautiful flower.
So
it's a beautiful plant.
What you need
is
you need a lot of hoverflies, and the hoverflies will eat the aphids.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing you can do there. Imported cabbage worms came in fourth. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. If you see these little white butterflies in your garden, take action to protect your brassicas and before the cabbage worm moth lay eggs.
Your brassicas, those are going to be your your broccoli and your mm-hmm. mustard green and anything in the mustard family, but especially your broccoli and your cauliflower and your kale. Yeah.
So then there's squash vine borers. There's all sorts of interesting things that can get into your garden and mess things up.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to kind of go after their eggs. You have to wait for them to lay their eggs, and then you have to squish their eggs. So there's an awful lot of visual and maintenance that you have to do when you're in the garden.
Yeah.
Which is why we're in the garden so much.
Right.
Which is why we go to our local
farmer's
market.
Yeah, if I didn't have to work all the time.
And you know, a tip of the hat to all you out there that are spending the time in your gardens. Good for you.
I think
it's awesome.
Actively gardening.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I feel like I do my part because I teach people that it's a good thing to garden. I encourage people who garden. And if you don't have time to garden because you work a lot or you're running the kids around or you have a commute or whatever the deal is, don't feel bad. Don't be hard on yourself. You can go to the farmer's market. That's why we have farmer's markets. I help people with their healing. I talk to people about healing. I sit here on the radio and offer people advice about healing. And Brian grows my food for me. It works. It all works.
Yeah.
It's great. I really, really appreciate it. I mean, and hopefully one day I'll be able to retire. And when I retire, then I'll have time to do a garden.
Yeah,
and
you let the experts do what they do and you do what you do. And
I don't know that I'd be an expert, but we do have a couple of plants sitting that are waiting to get planted. We have a tomato plant.
We do.
So we'll plant the tomato plant.
Mm-hmm.
We'll
get have been planted about 3 weeks ago, but that's all right.
You know what?
Still
We're
going to
plant
still
it.
Still alive.
Yes. Mm. I mean, you don't get the good tomatoes until August anyway.
Right.
So we'll put it in the ground. We've got lovely compost. We do keep a compost pile.
Yeah, we do.
Very good about it, although I think we're feeding the critters. So
that's okay, too.
It's going to be excessively hot the next couple of days. We might have a heat wave. Heat wave, by the way, is defined as 3 or more days of temperatures above 90 degrees. So that might happen. Not sure, but it might. We'll see if it gets up to 90 degrees today. I think it's supposed to.
So how do you, the good doctor, deal with the heat wave?
Yeah, right. It's like a heat wave burning in my heart. Can't keep from crying.
Yeah.
It's tearing me apart. That's a quote.
That's a musical quote.
Yes, it's a musical quote. Yeah, that was Linda Ronstadt. That was probably not originally. I think that was the...
I think it was before that. Might have been like the Rondells or somebody. Who knows?
Something. Because ending the name of a band in Dell was a thing in the 50s.
Yeah.
So according to Weatherbug, we're going to see 89. let's see what Weather Underground says, what we're going to see today. So Weather Underground says that we are going to see 93 here in stores. So we'll see what actually happens. So I have two weather services that are disagreeing with each other. we can go to, let's see if I go to the National Weather Service, what they're going to say. This is the Weather Channel. Oh, this is weather.com. I don't know what they're going to say.
By the way, little flashback here on heat wave.
Yes.
Martha and the Vandellas.
The Vandellas. It's a lot of Dell in it.
There you go. 1963.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It's as old as me.
For those of you that are music geeks, radio geeks out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, how do you deal with heat? Well, the first thing to do is to drink water, is to not let yourself get dehydrated.
Isn't that the truth? Very
important.
And we see that. We see people who don't drink enough water, even doing the things that we're doing, and you see them run into major problems if they don't drink enough.
So if you're a person who sweats a lot, so you know how we talk about if you're only going to do an hour or less of exercise, just drink plain water. In this weather, it depends. Now, if you're doing that hour or less of exercise indoors, and you don't sweat an inordinate amount, plain water is probably fine. Mm-hmm. If you are doing very hard exercise indoors, you could use a little bit of electrolyte. If you are doing hard exercise outdoors, you probably do want to use some electrolyte. And remember, the easiest way to do electrolyte is whatever volume of liquid you're going to prepare, a quarter of the volume fruit juice, your favorite fruit juice, it all has potassium in it, 3/4 volume of water, pinch of sea salt, off you go.
Right.
And that's electrolyte drink. You don't have to buy anything special. You can even take actual fruit and squeeze it into a level of about 1/4 cup, 3/4 water, pinch of sea salt, off you go. So why would you do salt? And people are so afraid of salt. And the idea, because we've been conditioned to believe that salt causes hypertension. And that belief that salt causes hypertension is it's fueled by the fact that most people eat way more salt than they should. They eat salt in processed food, and the salt content is incredibly high in processed food. Hmm. And they eat the processed food, and they don't eat natural produce along with that. So you and I, when we eat our big salads, we eat enormous salads, and then we put a little bit of salt on top of it. That's not a big deal, because our ratio of potassium, calcium, magnesium to salt is so high.
Well, we also drink a lot of water, so we dilute a lot of what we eat.
You drink a lot. That's the other thing.
Right?
If you drink a lot of water, you're absolutely right. You're going to be diluting the salt.
Because remember that deal where the U.S. military was having all these problems with kidney stones?
Yes.
Because they were drinking one of the aids?
A commercial sport drink, instead of water, but they weren't. Right. They were probably not being physically active enough to sweat. So they were getting kidney stones because they were getting way too much electrolyte and it wasn't dilute enough.
And there wasn't dilute, right?
Yes.
The problem was is that, you know, you drink one of those bottles of something aid and you, but you drink a bottle of water to go along with it. In other words, one for one, and then you dilute it enough.
Well,
so
it depends what's going on. If you're sweating a lot, but the thing is, it may have been that those people were actually not sweating enough, or they were drinking so much sport drink that it didn't. Like if you're out there doing very very sweaty exercise at a high intensity and sweating a lot, the sport drink is probably okay. Although I find that for myself, I don't drink sport drinks straight unless I'm actually not feeling well. I mean, in my water bottles, when I go out on the road on my bike, what I'm drinking is fairly dilute, and I also carry electrolyte tablets with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I need to carry electrolyte tablets with me, not just for me.
For everyone, yeah.
For everyone.
You've rescued a few people recently.
Yeah, mm-hmm. so that's what I do. And so why is that happening to people? Well, people are having issues because they're not pre-hydrating. So you have to stay hydrated all the time. And Ron and I, you're drinking coffee, which
I am.
That's all right. And there's controversy as to whether coffee dehydrates you. It may dehydrate you a little bit, but if you're drinking a lot of volume of it, it's still hydrating you. Right now, I'm sitting inside a studio, and the studio is fairly cool. So I have plain water. I'm not going to drink sport drink right now.
Well, and I'm drinking a cup of coffee, but I've already had two big bottles of water this morning.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, that's the thing.
It's what, like, but that was paired with exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
So you all already
before,
sweat
during,
a bunch.
And after I had water.
Yep. So you want to prehydrate. This is a good time of year to have water near your person all the time. And if you're not moving, if you're in a situation where you're sitting at a desk, you're sitting in the car, and in the car, I think that's a good time to have a little water bottle next to you.
Mm-hmm.
And have
all the time.
Right. And that's a good time to be drinking, that you want to be prehydrating so that when you get outside, you're not depleted. And if you're sitting and, you know, watching some TV or sitting and relaxing, have a drink next to you.
And if you get in the habit of it, it's really easy.
Right.
You know, it's like you did that really big bike ride a couple of weekends ago. It's very hot. It was a really hot day. There were so many people that were having problems with dehydration.
Right.
And one of the tips that I gave to them was, people that were asking about it the day before, is that if you drink enough so that you have to get up in the middle of the night and use the bathroom once or twice, then that helps base your hydration level in your body and makes it a lot easier to deal with.
And when
with
you get
the
to the rest stop, you should be looking for the bathroom.
And you just be, if you're looking for the bathroom when you get to the rest stop, you did it right.
Yeah.
If you're looking for more water when you get a rest stop, maybe you should
be looking but you should be looking for more water anyway.
Yeah,
regardless.
Exactly. Oh, yes, that too.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And it was so hot that I was drinking, I was taking electrolyte, and I still had baby cramps. I didn't cramp out. I didn't cramp so that I had to stop. I had little teeny cramps that I was able to work through.
Little twinges.
And drink more electrolyte and get through. And that was an incredibly hilly, hot ride. And so today I'm going to go out, and I'm going to be very careful. I'm going to carry a couple water bottles with me and electrolyte tabs. I have these lovely electrolyte tabs that you can chew. I don't think you have to chew them, but I kind of feel like you're going to absorb them better if you do chew them. They taste like obnoxious salt and seaweed.
I was going to say, they probably taste really salty.
They do. Mm. So you eat them, and then you take some fluid with them. But that's important to do if you're outside. So you landscapers out there, you landscapers and contractors, you have my permission to do electrolyte drink. I would drink water also. And you also may want to carry electrolyte tabs with you because you're out there in the heat. You're sweating a lot. You're very physically active. Make sure you drink plain water, too. If you're drinking electrolyte drink, I think it's a good idea what Ron says. If you do tend to drink electrolyte drink, to pair it with plain water because you do want to dilute it. Because what you said, people who were stationed in Iraq were drinking a lot of sport drink and they were getting kidney stones, probably because they were precipitating out too much calcium because there may have been some calcium in the sport drink they were consuming. And they were precipitating it out because what they were drinking wasn't dilute enough. And they weren't sweating enough to warrant the amount of sport drink they were drinking. And those sport drinks have a lot of sugar in them. And why do they have sugar in them? That's not necessarily a bad thing. The reason that there is sugar and salt in sport drink is because you will absorb liquid faster when you consume fluid that has sugar and salt in it. Mm-hmm. That's why when you go to the tropics, you go to the juice bar, they'll give you a juice drink and it'll have salt around the rim. That thing that we think is really cool. Oh boy, you get your margarita, salt around the rim. Reason that's done is because when you go to the tropics, they routinely, anything that has fruit in it, they hand you a fruit juice and it's got salt around the rim because they know that the salt paired with the sugar in the fruit and the fruit juice is going to help you absorb that water faster. So so that's really important to do. And then eating fruit this time of year is a good thing. Eating produce, eating mostly stuff with a lot of water in it is really good for you. So when you're going to that picnic, if you're focusing on the hot dogs and hamburgers and the buns and you're not eating any of the salads and the watermelon, that you're missing out. You're missing out in a lot of ways. Having mostly produce, this time of year is the most wonderful time to have the produce because all the produce is fresh and local and ready. And it's also, by the way, full of water, and it's in a form that helps you to absorb the water very well. I go nuts for fruit this time of year because there's so many different kinds of fruit available, and then I buy too much. And it was nice this weekend because I had family over, and I was able to make big fruit salads, and it got eaten. So that was good. But I just love the variety that's available, and a lot of the stuff is local. And by the way, you can go picking this time of year. I think the strawberries are about done, but the blueberries by far are not, and you can go blueberry picking now. And Windsong Farm is open, among other farms, at Windsong Farms out in Pomfret. And there are many other places you can go and pick blueberries, and finding your local pickery would be a great thing to do.
Pickery?
Yes.
Is that what that's called, a pickery?
No.
No.
No. And it's there are other farms. Though. There's a farm down the road where you can pick raspberries. So if you enjoy picking your own fruit, you can do that. And you can just go to those farms and they'll have stuff already picked for you as well. But I enjoy going in, maybe once a year and picking some blueberries. I think that's a nice thing. And we have wild berries growing on the power lines right now because where we live, we have acidic soil because we have a lot of pine trees. So we've got, name your berry. It's growing. We've got wild black raspberries that I had when it was really tasty.
And yeah, those are good.
Wild red raspberries. And I didn't realize, there is a difference between a black raspberry and a blackberry. They are not the same thing. Black raspberries are shaped like raspberries, but they're deep purple.
Deep purple. Smoke on the water.
I had to do that. All right. So stay hydrated, people. Okay, the other thing is, let's talk about sunscreens for a minute. So watch your oxybenzones and your avobenzones and your methoxycinnamates. Those are things that are not necessarily good for you on your skin. If you can. Now, there's controversy about those things. If you're going to burn badly and the only thing you have around is those things, you might want to use some of that sunscreen. But if you can manage to get to the health food store and get things with optical barriers, so that's going to be your stuff with titanium and zinc oxide in it. They just sit on your skin and then they wash off later. And they're very effective sunscreens. And you can get those, and you can get wonderful products that are just have minerals in them and have really good ingredients and have really healthy oils in them. And you can go to your health food store and get those things. So those are generally better things to get. So there's another thing that people get sometimes that I see, and that's heat rash. And so heat rash is also known as milariasis. You wouldn't know anything about that.
No.
Yeah, well, you have to have intertriginous zones, which you barely have.
I have to have what zones?
Yeah. Intertriginous zones.
What the heck is an
intertriginous zone? It's a zone that's in between a thing and another thing on your body.
Like your armpit.
You got it. Your armpit, your inguinal region, which is where your legs...
You could have said that. I would have understood that.
I'm teaching them what an intertriginous zone is. Now you know what one is. You didn't know before.
Now we know.
All right. Mm. So your intertriginous zone. So your inguinal region, the where your leg attaches to your torso.
Right.
For women, under our breasts, under and between our breasts, that's a really great place because we wear bras.
Right.
And sometimes we don't wear bras, and it's a great place to sweat. And so so sweat is very tasty if you're a bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a bacteria, you're going to go, sweat. And so you're going to tend to be more likely to get, unfortunately, you're going to tend to be more likely to get heat rash if you're heavy or if you're well endowed or simply if you sweat a lot, but you don't have a lot of physical activity. The thing is, if you sweat a lot and you're very active, sweat from exercise is thin because your body's priority is getting water out to cool you off. So the sweat from physical activity tends to be thin. It tends to just be liquid, that's why it's very important for you to replace it with more liquid. But sweat from just sitting around or being nervous has more stuff in it, has more protein in it, and it has more yummy stuff for bacteria to eat. So if you're sitting around and sweating, you're more likely to get a heat rash. So what's going on there is your sweat glands are sending out this sweat, and it's got some protein in it. And the bacteria that live on your skin, like your friendly Staphylococcus aureus, which lives on all of our skin, and then, you know, if it's mostly it just hangs out. But if it has an opportunity and you give it protein to eat, it'll munch on it.
If it sees the buffet, it's going to go.
Yes. Meanwhile, it just will sit there and eat minor amounts of stuff and not cause a problem. But if your sweat glands are spitting out all this delicious protein, then they're going to go to town. And then you get these little itchy bumps. Mm-hmm. And so the bacteria, once your immune system sees bacteria overgrowing, it goes, uh-uh. And it's going to start sending out white blood cells to munch on the bacteria. Now you have an inflammatory situation. So to get rid of that, there's some things you can do. One is it's questionable. There's controversy about whether you should wear cotton versus whether you should wear synthetics. So if you tend to sweat a lot, I would experiment because wearing cotton can be really comfy and cool. I love to wear linen shorts this time of year. Linen is so lovely and cool. And you can get linen now inexpensively at your friendly local wherever. Mm-hmm. But linen shorts, like loose linen shorts, one of my favorites for this time of year. And so wearing linen can be nice. But in terms of your bra, you have to experiment.
Linen is cotton, correct?
No.
No? It's not?
No. Linen is not cotton. Linen is its own thing.
It's its own thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Cotton is a plant that's the cotton plant.
Right.
And linen is made from flax.
From flax.
Yeah, linum usitatissimum.
But of course.
Linen is a fiber that is made from the flax plant. Yes. Same place you get your flax seeds, which you take for your essential fatty acids and your fiber and all that good stuff. I tend to prefer chia, but that's okay. For my fiber, just because you get a little more bang for your buck. And if I'm going to buy one or the other, I'm probably going to buy chia, but it's fine to buy both. And, you know, the flax seeds you have to grind and the chia seeds you don't. So
the same thing that makes the flax seeds is what makes the linen.
Yes.
Ah.
Well, linen, flax plants make.
I see.
That's what you make
same
linen.
Same plant. Gotcha.
Right. And so, but in terms, but for your bra, the bra is holding you up right against your body. So you have to experiment with whether a cotton bra is going to work for you or get a synthetic fabric that's a sport fabric that's wicking and see if that works better for you. It makes it so that you sweat less.
As long as you don't have a reaction to the synthetic fabric against your skin.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
some people do.
I guess some people do, but you know, most people who wear synthetics, you know, we wear synthetics for sports.
Yeah, those of us in the sports area,
right? That's what I'm saying.
So
somebody who tends to sweat a lot may need a wicking fabric, and that might work better for them. And so there's that. And then there's what if you actually have the heat rash already? So you want to get rid of it. I tell people to go get. I suggest that people go get toner, the things that you use as facial toner. And if you can get just facial, whatever your favorite facial toner is from the drugstore, even that works. And if you can get facial toner from the health food store, that's fine too. And it should have ingredients in it like thyme oil, menthol, rosemary oil. It might have tea tree oil in it, might have cajeput oil in it, but it's going to have some of those astringent oils and also witch hazel, especially witch hazel. And all of those things are astringent and antimicrobial. So you just clean off the area with that product and your heat rash will go away in a couple of days. It's really quite remarkable. And then you start using a powder, but don't use talcum powder. You want to use a powder that is clay.
Definitely don't use talcum powder. There's a big deal out there about that right now.
Use something that's clay-based and has essential oils in it. So I like to see clay-based powders that have, again, essential oils like tea tree oil, thyme oil, menthol. All of those things are going to absorb sweat and be antimicrobial.
So for those of us who don't really know what a toner is because we don't prep that way.
Yeah.
Can you just use like witch hazel?
Yes, well, witch hazel is a toner. So when we talk about a toner, we're talking about...
It sounds like some sort of a makeup thing.
Yeah, well, the word toner is usually used to refer to a beauty product that tones up your skin, that will tighten it up. So you use a toner, I don't know if you do, but most men will use a toner after they shave.
Right.
Because aftershave is a toner.
Right. Aftershave.
Yes.
Right.
So toners are generally astringent. They dry things out a little bit.
Just trying
to
clear things up for my construction buddies.
Yes. Right. So aftershave might work too, but aftershave, depending on what aftershave you're using, your aftershave is going to be perfumey. And if you're not looking for the perfumey, then because if you use straight witch hazel, that may work too. But I like to recommend the toners because they have more ingredients than just witch hazel. They'll have the thyme oil, maybe cajeput oil, maybe tea tree oil. They're going to have other volatile oils that are antimicrobial in them, and it'll kill the bugs, any fungus or bacteria that are growing on your skin. It'll tend to dry it out. And then you use the powder. And then, you know, when you're sitting around and hanging out, make sure you have a fan on you, or you have air conditioning, or that you're in a place where you can be cooled off. So there's another condition that we talk about sometimes, that's swimmer's ear. So swimmer's ear will happen when it's otitis externa. So it's a condition where you get a little fungal infection in your ear canal. And you usually it's not uncomfortable, but if you go to the doctor's office, they'll look and they'll go, oh, you got a little funky ear in there. And if you touch your ear, okay? If you touch your ear and you find there's stuff in your ear and then you find that it has an odor, like it has a kind of a cheesy odor, you've got a little otitis externa.
Okay.
So if it's bothering you, because it can be like smoldering and not bother you, and it can also be uncomfortable. It can start to itch and hurt. And it's the ear canal proper, as opposed to when you have a viral ear infection, it usually attacks the middle ear. Sometimes if you have labyrinthitis, which is awful, it's the inner ear, and then you get dizzy, and you're dizzy for as long as you have the labyrinthitis.
That's not good.
But the otitis externa isn't so bad because it's the external ear, and it's very easy to access. So that's when you just get eardrops, and you get eardrops, again, that have tea tree oil in them, and you can use those. You can use tea tree, a little bit of tea tree oil and olive oil. That would be fine. So using just straight, and even plain olive oil can help, because olive oil is antiviral and antimicrobial. But I would recommend, if you have otitis externa, there's probably some fungus in there. So if you're going to make your own, you're going to put straight olive oil in, you might want to use a few drops of tea tree oil, because that's going to be a great antifungal. And you can buy already prepared eardrops for that purpose, and that'll have tea tree oil in it, maybe grapefruit seed extract. And you can also get eardrops that have xylitol in them. And that's really cool, because xylitol, it's not an essential oil. It's a sugar alcohol that is antimicrobial. The cells take it up because it thinks it's sugar, and then it doesn't work as sugar in the cell, and it kills the cell. It's kind of cool. So that's why there's xylitol in your toothpaste and xylitol candies that are good for your oral hygiene. So it's easy to get swimmer's ear this time of year because people swim a lot. And especially if your kids belong to a swim club, or you go to the lake, or you go to the beach, there's all kinds of, and you're in and out of the water all the time, you're more likely to get stuff like that.
I had a golden retriever who used to get swimmer's ear all the time. That's because once it got warm out, that I couldn't keep him out of the lake. He would just always be in the lake.
That's super cute.
So, but, when they have lots of hair and the water gets trapped, and then, they have that problem.
Like to call them golden receivers.
Yes. Well, that's because if you can get them to bring it back, they're a retriever. If they just go chase it and then
receiver.
Run around in circles and play the game like, okay, now I got it, it's your turn to get it from me, then they're receivers.
So I was on this bike ride on the 26th in New York, and it was super hot. And a guy was coming up behind me, and he was complaining, I think I have heat stroke. What's wrong with this picture?
If you think you have heat stroke, you wouldn't be able to figure
articulate
that out.
That.
You wouldn't be able to articulate
That's
it.
That's
right. Exactly.
Because
you would be in a really bad place.
I said, honey, you don't have heat stroke. You don't. You would be.
Right.
Because he was.
You'd
he
be
was
delirious.
Climbing, he was climbing the hill behind me, chatting with me and saying, I think I have heat stroke. I'm like, no, you don't have heat stroke.
No.
You might have heat exhaustion. And in fact, I don't even think you have that. Because if you had heat exhaustion, you still wouldn't. You would really not feel. You're just hot. So anyway, you're just sweating a lot and you don't actually have heat exhaustion. So let's talk about the difference between heat stroke and heat exhaustion. This is a great day to talk about that.
Yes, it is.
So first of all, just feeling hot and sweaty is not heat exhaustion. Heat exhaustion is when you begin to feel exhausted. If you're hot and sweaty and you feel like you need to drink extra, you're just hot and sweaty. Heat exhaustion is when your skin begins to feel cold and clammy and you might feel dizzy, you might feel a little bit queasy, but you're still maintaining your body temperature. And it's not necessarily a medical emergency. If somebody's having heat exhaustion symptoms, what you do is you get them somewhere cool, give them cold drinks to sip on. If you can give them a little electrolyte drink, that's a good thing. Have them rest. If you can get cold compresses, that's a great thing. And they're probably going to be okay. Heat stroke is different. Heat stroke or sunstroke, that's where the person is, they can no longer regulate their body temperature, and that is a medical emergency. So if somebody's getting delirious and their skin is really hot and red and dry and they're losing it, if you're in that state anyway, you should be calling 911. That is a medical emergency and emergency should be called. And if you think somebody's having heat stroke, you do some similar things while you're waiting for 911 to come. You do your general first aid monitoring, make sure that they have a pulse and that they're breathing. And if they don't, you initiate CPR if you're trained. And if you're not trained, go get trained, please. You just monitor them to make sure pulse and breathing are still happening. If you have anything to help keep them cool or fluids for them to sip on, if they can, you give that to them and you help them to be as cool as possible. And you make sure 911 is on the way, that the emergency services are on the way.
So how do you know if you have heat-related illnesses? There's a key here that says if you have lightheadedness, weakness, and nausea, you're on your way.
Oh, sure. And so the other thing is you'll know you have, because those symptoms can be a lot of things. And one way to figure out if it's a heat-related illness is to drink some water or water with electrolytes. And if you suddenly feel better, it's a heat-related illness. Because that happens to me sometimes. Oh, I don't feel good. And then I drink some fluid and I suddenly feel better. And I'm like, okay, I was a little dehydrated there. I quite honestly, not everybody likes this stuff, but I am a big fan of coconut water. I think that coconut water, if you like the way it tastes, it goes down easy. And if you like it, it goes down easy and it's pretty much instantly hydrating because it's got fluid, it's got sugar, it's got potassium in it. It gets the water in really fast. And I put coconut water in my sport drink water bottle. I always have coconut water in the house. It's one of my favorite things to use as a sport drink. I don't drink it full strength unless I'm actually out on the road in the middle of a sweaty bike ride. But when I'm preparing my water bottles, I'll dilute it. But I have it on hand all the time. I think it's a really it's really great. You know, if you think, oh, I'm going to eat a banana because it's high in potassium. Bananas are pretty high in potassium. One banana is going to have around 400 milligrams of potassium in it. But 8-ounce glass of coconut water has less than half as many calories, and it has almost twice as much potassium. It's just really, really high. If you want to get potassium in fast, coconut water is the way to go. People who have cramps, I tend to recommend that they, people with cramps, I tend to recommend that they drink coconut water. So let's talk about cramps, because that's a thing that happens too. It happens in, happens in the bed, and it happens when you're doing sweaty exercise, and it happens if you're just a person who sweats a lot. Also, if you are a person who takes diuretic drugs, this is a tough time of year for you. So if you take hydrochlorothiazide or you take furosemide, any diuretic drugs for whatever condition you may have, whether you have high blood pressure or you have edema for other reasons, if you have congestive heart failure or you simply have, poor venous return, you have a lot of varicose veins or whatever, and you get swollen legs and you're taking a diuretic. This is a time of year to pay attention to your hydration. You actually need to rehydrate when you take diuretics. The diuretics are helping you to get rid of the fluid,
But they're also drawing the essential fluid out of your body too.
And the electrolytes. So you're more likely to get leg cramps. So what I recommend to people like that. So I was on a bike ride, and we have a dear friend who happens to also be diabetic. So this is interesting. So this is for you people who are diabetic too. So if you're diabetic, whether you're type 1 or type 2, and you're taking an insulin regulating med, your needs for magnesium are higher than your average person, because magnesium is one of the minerals that helps to regulate blood sugar. And so you have higher needs for magnesium. So you should be getting extra magnesium on board anyway. Where do you get magnesium from? You get it mostly from leafy green vegetables. Any food that's green, not green M&Ms. Not that green stuff you get in the Slurpee at the slushy at the store. Green vegetables, anything green like that, anything that's a leaf is going to have lots of magnesium in it, because chlorophyll is green. It's the green pigment that's in plants, and at its center, it has magnesium in it. So you can get magnesium. So eat your salads. It's a good thing to eat your salads. Eat your green vegetables. Eat your broccoli.
And is it true the darker the green, the better?
Well, there's going to be more chlorophyll in it. So yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be more high magnesium content.
So we're not talking iceberg lettuce here.
No, you're probably going to get there's going to be more chlorophyll in something that's darker than
right.
that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sometimes the darkness is not just, it's not just the chlorophyll. There's also carotenoids. Like, you know how kale, if you leave it for a while, it won't be so green anymore and it's yellow,
mm-hmm.
right? When the chlorophyll gets consumed by the plant, you're left with a yellow kale leaf. Those are carotenoids, and those are good for you too, but they don't particularly have magnesium in them.
Mm-hmm.
So eating your leafy green vegetables. If it's hard for you to get all those leafy green vegetables in, it's a good idea to get magnesium. And what you do is you take magnesium to bowel tolerance. So you increase your magnesium dose by one pill a day until you get some loose stool. Then you back off to the last dose where you didn't have the loose stool. And then you're going to top up your magnesium stores. And that's it's important for everyone to do, to make sure you're getting good magnesium in. But if you're diabetic, it's particularly important. I think people with diabetes are going to be a little bit more likely to get those cramps, and people on the diuretics as well. It's a good idea to do the magnesium to bowel tolerance, and it might be good to supplement with some potassium and possibly even salt. But you want to have a preponderance of magnesium and potassium over the salt, because you're losing the whole point of taking a diuretic is to have salt leave the body so that the water follows it so that it lowers your blood pressure. I don't think it's a great plan. I think that using diuretics to lower blood pressure, although it can work, it messes people up, makes people dizzy, and it makes them heat intolerant, and it makes them lose their minerals. It's just not a good thing. If you're going to do a blood pressure drug, that you're better off doing drugs that don't work by that mechanism, whether it's an ACE inhibitor, an angiotensin II converting enzyme receptor antagonist, or a calcium channel blocker, whatever works for you, a central nervous system. Those aren't great because they depress your whole central nervous system. But if you have to take a drug, I'm kind of a fan of the angiotensin II converting enzyme receptor antagonists. Your things that end in sartan. Would not to be confused with sartén, which is a big frying pan in Spanish. Okay, so doing your minerals is really important. And if you're outside a lot, it's a good idea to carry your water, carry your fluid, and carry your electrolyte tablets with you. So that's really important. If you're a person that tends to get cramps, you might want to actually carry magnesium pills with you and carry electrolyte. You can get electrolyte tablets that you can carry with you. I have started carrying them on bike rides, and I carry extra, not just for me.
Yes, I've noticed that.
Yes, and I carry extra goos because I'm like, somebody's going to cramp out.
Because the good doctor is always in.
I'm concerned.
Mm.
I don't want somebody.
No, it's a good thing. We don't want to lose people on the side of the road.
No,
that's
I don't
not
want
fun.
People to get hurt. It's bad.
No fun at all.
So hydration and cramps. So there's a homeopathic company that came out with an a cramp salve, which I think is really cool. I'm excited to try it. So it's a homeopathic company. You may be able to get this at health food stores. I haven't looked to see what's in it, but I'm assuming that there's going to be some cramp bark in it, like viburnum, perhaps some wild yam, maybe some magnesium cell salts. So I'll take a look at it and I'll report back to you, see what it is. But it's something you can carry. You can carry little packets of it. And if you're out on a bike ride cramping, you can apply it and see if that works. The other thing about cramping is if you're doing a lot of exercise, there's an idea that it's the overuse of the nerves, that you're doing a repetitive activity and the nerves can't stop firing. So magnesium doesn't just work by replenishing the magnesium you're losing through sweat. It works by calming the nerves down. Another way to do that is with a counter irritant. And that would, for example, be by using cayenne pepper or capsaicin. And so you taste it. That is probably why pickle juice works as a cramp abort, as a thing that aborts cramps. It's not so much because there's a lot of salt in the pickle juice. It's because as soon as you taste it, it's a counter irritant because it's super sour and salty. And so your nerves taste it and it calms your nervous system down. It's a counter irritant. I think that's why pickle juice works and that's why cayenne pepper works. So it'd be a good thing to carry fire cider with you on a bike ride. Mm-hmm. You can also, somebody's making pickle juice shots and lozenges. I don't know about lozenges, but they're making shots
now.
Yeah.
You can put them in your back pocket.
They carry them
bicycle.
Conveniently, carry which them is, that's a yep. clever idea.
It is. So, it is.
And again, this is not just for cyclists and athletes. It's for people who work construction and people who work outside and people who work on farms and landscaping.
Yep, sure is.
Yes. Right. So so there you go. So that's a good wrap up. Those are a bunch of good things that you can do to help your health during the summer sun. There's more, and I think we'll talk about a few more next week, some stuff that we didn't talk about. So you're listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, and we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.